Is this thing on?
I'm Karen.
And I'm Challen.
Welcome again to Queer Air Season 2, a podcast where we, two library grad students at the University of Washington, take a deep dive into the archives to give you a breath of fresh queer air.
Yeah, so welcome everybody. Today we have another special guest, someone who is also in Season 1 of Queer Air. We wanted to bring them back. Abby, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hi, I'm Abby. This is me again on Season 2 of Queer Air. My pronouns are she, her. Presently, I live in Des Moines, Iowa and work for state government. And I graduated from the University of Washington's iSchool with a Master's of Library and Information Science in June of 2020.
Last time I reassured that Carolyn Parker wouldn't have to like pull an icebreaker or like a fun fact out of nowhere. But for this week's, I was like, maybe we could just briefly share our like astrology signs, our star signs. If you're into that, I would
love nothing more than to share my astrology signs with the two of you and your lovely listeners.
Yes, tell us.
I am a Cancer sun, but I have a Capricorn moon and a Scorpio rising.
Ooh, I only know my sun sign. So that's amazing. I'll go last though, because I think mine's contentious. What are you, Challen?
I'm a Taurus sun, a Libra moon, and a Scorpio rising. I only know what the Taurus means, but that's it.
Another Scorpio rising.
Yeah, that's good. We have something in common, you know, right off the bat.
Mm-hmm. So I only know that I'm a Gemini.
Yeah,
which is why I was like, maybe contentious. And I know that for some reason, I historically haven't gone along with Scorpios. So I'm glad it's not your like sun sign.
Yeah. I think that Geminis get like a fairly bad rap for who they actually are personally. I think that like the thing that people don't like about Geminis, that they're like, oh, like, you know, they're two-faced, like, you know, they say one thing and then do another. They say two things that are like in complete absolute contradiction of each other. But like someone told me something one time about how like the thing about all of Geminis like multiple sides isn't that any of them are necessarily more or less themselves than another one of their sides, and that like all of them together will make a Gemini, which helps me, I think, move past, you know, the contentiousness of being a Gemini. I also used to lie to people and tell them that I was a Gemini because my birthday is very close to Gemini season, and I thought that it was more interesting to be a Gemini than a Cancer,
which
I would argue is a pretty Gemini move to just like lie for sport.
I feel like that is a Gemini move. Yeah.
I'm so impressed. I feel like I've never heard of anyone like wanting to moonlight as a Gemini. So that's pretty awesome. I'll take that as a compliment.
I think you should. It was definitely meant as one.
Okay, so first question, Abby, where are you now post-graduation? And if you don't mind, maybe you could start by backing up a bit and walking us through some of your experience with archives. That can be as like a student worker at the University of Washington, your capstone, at the Northwest Archives Archivist in residence, any of that?
Yeah, definitely. So I will start where my archives career begins, all the way back in February of 2019, where I got a job as a student worker in the University of Washington Special Collections. While I was there as a student worker, I was working as a reference assistant, a reference specialist in the Special Collections reading room. And I was also working there in a couple different kind of like short-term project positions in digital projects, I believe was the department name at the time. And then also I was working there in the visual materials department as a processing assistant for my capstone, which was related to archiving and describing photographs from a 1970s to about 2000s collection of photojournalism that the archives had gotten from a recently deceased Seattle area photographer. I've had worked there in these kind of like different roles for about a year and a half. And in August of 2020, once I lost my status as a student worker from graduating, that is when I began working at the Labor Archives of Washington. I worked there for 3 months as their archivist in residence, which was a pilot program, which I'm happy to say has been renewed for at least a second year of funding with Northwest Archivists. The Northwest Archivists Archivist in Residency Project is essentially a grant that I proposed jointly with my supporting institution, which was the Labor Archives of Washington. And we worked to develop a project plan that was going to, you know, do some work for them, but also, you know, kind of try to meet my learning objectives as a new archivist. And it was paid, which is really cool because there aren't enough paid archival internships and residencies. I'm very excited about that. It's definitely an area I'm really passionate about. It's paying people for their labor. So I did that for about 3 months because that's how long the grant was for. And during that residency, it was done fully remotely. And a lot of the things we did for it were variations of sort of very typical like archival processing tasks. And then now I have a different job that's not in archives. I have a lot of panel presentations coming up for the Northwest Archivist project that I did, the archivist in residency. So I'm in the process of planning 4 different panel presentations at a couple different conferences this year, which is really exciting. I'm happy to, you know, still be involved in archives while I'm working a job that is not directly related to archives. And that kind of brings us up to the present.
I remember you were also working on an online exhibit while you were working at UW. Where does that fit in? I don't know if you mentioned
that.
Oh,
sure.
As well.
Yeah. So I can talk a little bit about that. The online exhibit I designed was initially going to be an in-person exhibit that I was going to be designing as part of my role as a reference specialist. It was supposed to kind of just be like a one case exhibit inside a library on the University of Washington's campus. And, you know, as things went remote, and also I should mention in March of last year, I just moved back to Iowa because of the pandemic anyway. So, you know, we couldn't do this. The libraries weren't open. We couldn't do it in person. So that was something that I was planning on kind of taking the material that I was looking at from my capstone and my work in visual materials of these photos of protests from the 1960s and 70s and use my budget from the reference specialist position to kind of daylight this material. And as it became clear that a in-person exhibit was definitely not going to happen, we transitioned into designing an online exhibit instead to kind of highlight some of the more, just a lot of photos. And we also were able to incorporate some other documents as well from other collections besides the one that I was processing specifically, which was the Grant Holler photograph collection, just for reference. Yeah, so that was in the summer of 2020.
Were you able to kind of work with any queer collections or the queer community or other queer archivists, anything sort of queer, like during your time at UW or even now?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you for asking that. I am sorry to say that, unfortunately, I really haven't worked with that many queer collections. But when I was processing the Grant Holler collection, because the scope is so wide, Grant Holler was a photojournalist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which was a newspaper. I believe it's still online now, but it used to be a print newspaper. And he would photograph mostly on like local news. So there were quite a few, you know, like very early, not very early, but like, you know, like mid 70s to late 70s gay pride protests, not parades, but protests. So there was a lot of stuff in there, some really cool photos that I got to look at. I really like looking at material that's a little bit more personal. And to me, things like photos and letters definitely like hit that mark. No letters, unfortunately, but so I got to work with the collection there. And then working with Carolyn Parker, of course, when they had me as a guest on their last pod or on the last season of this show, I consider to be working with other queer archivists. And shoot, there was one more thing. Oh yeah, Parker and I did an independent study together. The class that we designed was called Queer and Trans Archives, I believe. And we did a lot of reading together, reading books, reading articles, looking at collections, like other queer archives, kind of the differences between like community archives that are run by like queer community archives, and then more formally like institutionalized queer collections. So yeah, I think that's sort of pretty much, unfortunately, kind of all the experience I have directly working with queer archives.
It's hard to find queer spaces and queer archives in the field.
Yeah. I guess my question is like, what in and of itself makes an archives queer? When I think about like myself and what makes me queer, like it's not just that I'm dating another queer person. It's like other things about me. It's not just like this like relationship I have. Like that's not the only part of my life that is gay. And that's not the only way that I want to be perceived as gay, is like through this sort of like contextual connection with other people. So like, I don't know, like is me processing a collection as a queer person, does that make the collection queer in and of itself? I don't think it, I don't know, maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but like, I kind of want to like interrogate what are the parameters for something being like a queer archives or something, you know, along those lines, like what makes a collection queer? Does like, are queer workers what makes it queer?
That is so fascinating, because this actually came up with Parker brought up this nice. Like study about what it was like a specific study about queers and their nightstands.
Yeah, we read that in that class. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and Parker was just talking about like, does owning something as a queer person make an object queer, or is there some like inherent queerness in objects themselves? And I think you're kind of like posing that, but like at the archives level. And
yeah.
I think it's really interesting. Yeah, because obviously I'm sure there's a lot of queer archivists who are working with materials that aren't, you know, extravagantly gay or anything. But yeah, I think definitely like as a queer person, you have a perspective that is probably against the grain of what most institutions' perspectives are. So I think like that probably would filter into your work, regardless of whether or not the actual, you know, documents you're working with are queer.
Yeah. It's definitely still something I'm kind of trying to like figure out where I stand on, but I mean, it's definitely something like that I think about often, is like how are we going to define queerness, especially like the word queer in and of itself comes from like a very specific political kind of context. And also on top of that, like using queer as not just, you know, an adjective or even a noun, but as a verb itself, like queering a collection, like I find that like as a queer person, it does kind of change like my perspective on how I see pretty much everything, since between like when I'm like, you know, came out to myself and when before, you know.
Yeah, there's like multiple ways that I want to go with this. I guess the first is that, yeah, I think like it's really important, like regardless of whether or not you're working on a queer archive stuff at the moment, just to like see that there's other queer like people in the MLIS program, and just see like that you're doing good work and continuing to engage with all this, like putting on the panels and like talking to us. And I just wanted to shout out that I think it was at the UW Special Collections like student worker showcase that both you and Parker were like presenting. And that's like when I first met you, I think. I remember like thinking that y'all's work were both like super interesting, and you were both super like welcoming and being like, yeah, like please reach out to me. And then like I started emailing you. So I just think like just like you being there was super important for me to get involved. And it was just like, I'm just so grateful for like that moment of connection, which was super spontaneous. And then like as I went on, I like was talking to Carol, who I worked with, and like this like, you know, passing on of the capstone kind of naturally happened.
Yeah. But, Thank you for saying that. That really does like mean a lot to me. It was super great to like see other people besides like me and Parker down in the archives being like, is anyone else gay down here? No. Well, there were, but it was nice to kind of see
we're wondering, like, how does the archives factor into queerness? And maybe specifically, like, what would you say is the importance of archives work, especially for queer folks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely, it's a really big question, I think. And it's definitely one I feel like any answer I give is only going to be kind of partial because of like my own limited understanding of like queerness and archives. Like a lot of us, I guess, like, I don't know, I don't think that like queer people necessarily always like grow up with like an understanding of their queerness and like what it means to be a queer person in like very different parts of their life. As like a child or like as an adolescent or like even as like an older person. Like for me right now, imagining myself as like a little old gay lady is kind of difficult. But I think that like being able to like connect very particular aspects of other people's queer lives, whether it's like we talked about a little bit before, like, you know, their queer relationships, which is just one aspect of queerness. Or if it's things like, you know, what they did for work, how they made money, those kinds of like experiences that you have that, you know, you kind of have to, I don't know, in some senses, like, you know, maybe put your queerness on the back burner. Like those are the things that are really interesting to me in queer archives is like kind of watching people through archives, like negotiate their own queer identities is like really fascinating to me. Letters that like, you know, you write to one person who you say one thing or like, you know, and then like later you say something else to someone, like someone different based on like your relationship to them or not. Those kinds of things I think are really important for queer archives. One aspect of queerness that is hard to capture in archives is like this sense of like dialogue and community. I think that those things are like super important to at least my like queerness, like being in community with other queer people or other people with the same like political aspirations for like abolition and like community. Those kinds of things are important to me as a queer person. So I think like having like discussions and oral history kind of things are super important for queer archives so that folks can understand that like, at least for me, like queerness is very relational and not just like in a relationship way, as I've said before, but like in like friendships, you know, comrades, that kind of stuff, I think is especially important to be able to capture in archives.
I can just kind of tell from experience. I was kind of looking through this one collection and it was this man who created these huge scrapbooks, multiple of them, about his life with his partner and his partner's history in the military, as well as his and what they did after the military together. And yeah, just kind of like seeing the pictures that he put and the comments that he put under the pictures, because he captioned all of them. Yeah, just kind of seeing like a bunch of gay men, you know, living together in the same house and having fun with each other. And I know for especially like gay men who like are my generation and never really had to go through the AIDS crisis or anything like that, kind of conceptualizing the idea that there were groups of like queer people in like the 70s and the 80s who were happy and didn't have like a care in the world, just it's kind of mind-blowing.
Right, it is mind-blowing. Are we only seeing, when we like have queer collections with such like small volume content, are we only seeing like the tragedy, or like I would love to see more like queer joy in archives, especially from like earlier periods of time.
I love the idea of like queer joy and seeing that in the archives, because it is really difficult to find, and people love to focus on like the big historical events, you know, and those, especially for underrepresented people, are more often violent and oppressive than happy.
I'm
curious to see like what you think about how to bring in those happy queer voices, not to like say that the sad ones are not relevant, because obviously they're incredibly important, but to also bring in this other side too.
I would also say that, like, you know, especially as like a white lesbian myself, that like looking at queer collections and like doing queer historical collecting, I think is also important, because the purpose of an archives is like a site of cultural inquiry. And like, it's a way for us to push back on the historical record. But I think it's also a way for like white queers in this context to like interrogate our own history of like being oppressive inside queer communities. One thing that's particularly interesting to me is like thinking about the ways that like white queer people have adopted and like appropriated the language of Black people throughout, like in the South, like everywhere, and that these are kinds of like doing more queer archival work is a way for us to like kind of practice like accountability and like white queer people steal words and say that they're their own, or steal ideas and say that they're their own, and like a more comprehensive queer archives and like a general sense of the word archives would be a super helpful way for white queer people to start unpacking the ways that they contribute to the oppression of Black people.
Yeah, I think in a more like humorous way, Challen and I have touched on like how the archives can also be like a space for pulling out receipts. I think that's really interesting because I think those are two threads, like the queer joy instead of focusing on, yeah, queer trauma, but at the same time also like when there are traumatic moments, like not purely focusing on the victim, but rather like, you know, accountability and responsibility is a really big part of how archives can be like transformative instead of, yeah, just what you're saying, like merely a record or like something that's not challenging or like pushing history as we know it.
Yeah, and I think as like all archivists ourselves, we understand like implicitly that like the historical record is not the historical record. There's like definitely like a lot of work to be done in queer archives to make it a little bit more in general representative and like the like range of emotions and like actions that you can use with archives, I think, afterwards, instead of just, I mean, with all archives, but like I think especially there's a lot of room to grow with like documenting kinds of like emotions in queer archives.
To bring it to a more personal level, how has your work in archives influenced your identities, your worldview, and maybe especially as it relates to like queer issues?
I think that like archives have definitely affected my worldview in a lot of ways. One, like I know that I'm already deeply affected by surveillance culture by living in the United States. And like always having my stupid phone with me, like letting it just spy on me all the time, like submitting to being recorded, like, you know, what, all that kind of stuff. But I think that like being involved in archives for better or for worse has like really truly amplified my sense of the pervasiveness of surveillance culture, that anything you do or say could end up somewhere in someone's hands that you don't even know, whether that's a good or a bad thing. It's definitely a possibility. So like as a queer person who lives in a very oppressive state for queer people, I live in Iowa and our government hates queer people here. There were 15 anti-trans laws that were in our, like in the Senate, I think this Senate session, luckily none of them made it past like their deadline to be discussed on the floor. But pretty much my point in bringing that up is like, as like, even as like an out queer person, like working in archives has definitely made me aware of the ways that I could potentially be like doxxed, I guess, for like, or like being outed for being gay. Even though I'm like comfortable like being out now, I might not always feel that way depending on kind of like the political climate that whatever happens next, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But it's definitely like something that I try to like, you know, always identify myself as queer in spaces that I want to be identified with the knowledge that someday I might not want this and that someday this could be an issue. But those kinds of like security culture, surveillance culture stuff with archives, it's like really heightened my sense of like awareness in like direct actions of, you know, newspapers taking photographs of protesters who don't want to be taken photographs of. So that definitely was like a big, like, the archives aren't as safe as we think they are kind of thing as well. Like knowing that anything that is in an archives could be used, even if the event is already passed, it could be used as like evidence. That is like the biggest way I think that archives has affected my life. Again, I think the connection to queerness is occasionally kind of tenuous, but I would argue that like, but like I do identify like as a dyke, and I think that that is like a political stance, and that's why like I very rarely identify as a lesbian, because I don't think that it has the same political connotations as being a dyke does.
I love saying the word faggot because I identify as that because I think it's very funny to me, and it's also me taking the power back from oppressors. And it's, exactly, it's definitely a political stance for me to say that, especially in straight spaces. I think you also just really brought this great concept that I really have to unpack later, but this idea of how much power we as archivists have over people's lives, the power to either do good or destroy. And like, we've seen it used in both ways so often, but especially with like queer voices and queer history. And, you know, sometimes I know one time I was processing a collection and it was about regular legislative documents, but I found a slip in there, you know, that was very personal. And it's one of those things where I could just be like, you know, I'm going to keep that in there, or I'm going to like make note of it, you know, in the finding aid. And that's just kind of outing somebody. And it's something I have the power to do. We all do. And it's something that we need to be aware of, especially with surveillance culture, because who knows, 20, 30 years down the road, somebody could look that up and then make a big deal about it.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of like Afrofuturism recently, and the idea that like, reading it is like very like uplifting in some ways, but it's also like, I'm reading Octavia E. Butler's Parable of the Talents right now, which is pretty much just like what's happening in America in real life, but in like fictional 2033. And like, it's really made me think a lot about like, you know what? I know that there's like this like deep seated American fantasy of like, you know, every day is better and that progress, no matter what, like progress is always in and of itself good, but like, I don't know, the more I read, the more I'm like, I know things are okay now and they appear to be getting better. Also, I just don't, I won't go into it, but like, I think that gay marriage was a really bad idea because it makes everyone feel like they need to, like the gay people can be like fully assimilated into straight people culture, which is not something I even want personally. But I think that that's been like a really big catalyst for, you know, kind of like slowly rolling back rights in other kinds of areas, like, you know, like trans rights, you know, being able to adopt children, those kinds of things. So like the idea that it could be worse in the future is like definitely something that's like very much on the forefront of my mind after this like year of everything that happened, as they say, just too exhaustive of a list to really like get into in detail. But
I think it's just so much like arose from what we're talking about right now. But I think what I've been reading a lot of is just to speak to your point about like progress being always framed as like American dream, like go, 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 grind culture, capitalism, and like how all of these things are bad for not just queer folks, but like literally everyone, but we all still buy into it and assimilate into it. And it's just like, I don't know, I'm always asking this question of like, if your foot was on my neck, like, but then you're gonna offer me a hand to like join you in pressing my foot on other people's necks. Like, why is that something that I want? And a lot of it's just like conditioning, right? So a lot of what I'm interacting with, like kind of along the lines of what you're reading, is just books about like pausing and like stopping and like resisting as like a form of rest and like just not engaging with stuff like that. And it kind of, absolutely. And it kind of like dovetails with remembering, but also forgetting, and like the right to like remain silent, basically, to like not participate in archives, and how that is like just as important as what's being preserved. So I think you're bringing up a lot of like really critical questions for us not to like answer right now, but to keep thinking about. And I just really love that you're like, you know, connecting this to queerness, not just as a personal like identity, but also like a political one, and like, you know, those things not being different, but all wrapped up into like what it means to be a queer person in the US right now. So I think that's really good.
Definitely.
I guess I'm so like sad that our time is flying away, but our next question is like a little lighter, I think. I was just kind of curious, like, in your opinion and experience, what are some interesting trends that you're seeing, not even necessarily in queer archives, but just in, like, the queer community? And that could be in terms of, like, activism and politics, but also, like, you know, even TikTok. And, like, where, like, I guess, where are you finding queer community? And maybe even, like, how is that a little different between when you were here in Washington versus now in Iowa?
This is a really exciting question as well. I'll answer the first one about archives and then maybe go into a little bit where I'm finding queer community these days after. I think that a really interesting trend that I don't think is specific to queer archives, I've seen in other places as well, but I think is, like, for me, like, the future of oral histories is having, instead of an archivist interviewing a participant, the participants work with the archivist, all of them work together to develop questions, and then the two participants interview each other instead of the archivist interviewing them. And it's just, like, blows my mind that we haven't thought about this before yet. Like, it's so, like, I think, especially with, like, queer archives, as I mentioned before, like, community and dialogue are both very, like, quintessential, like, queer things to me that are very hard to capture in, like, traditional archival formats. And even in something like an oral history, it can still be kind of challenging. But when you have, like, two people, maybe even if the archivist is queer, like, you know, who cares? They're still an archivist and they still have these perspectives that they're bringing to the table that are valuable, but also kind of can sometimes miss the nuances of, like, two people just having kind of, like, a informal but structured conversation. Like, the questions that can arise from, like, the back and forth, and, you know, after one person interviews another person, like, person A interviews person B, then person B interviews person A, like, putting those interviews together as, like, one document is, like, I don't know if I've necessarily seen that, but I think that that idea is, like, super, super interesting to me. And your other question was about where I'm finding queer community these days. I'm involved in a couple of mutual aid groups and also a group of street medics and street medicine. And I've been finding a lot of queer community in that these days. So that to me has been kind of, I don't think liberating is the right word, but I've been feeling like very much like in community with other queer people doing work and being recognized for the work that it is and knowing that this is like caring for other people in direct ways and like physical ways, and, like emotional ways and spiritual ways is work, and it's not going to be recognized as something besides work, you know, like that it is labor. So that's been very nice for me lately.
Yeah, I think like a lot of people, especially right now, are thinking about what even is work and like who's doing the work. And yeah, historically, like women and queer folks have had to step up and take care of, you know, everyone. I think it's really awesome that you found like a,
yeah,
I don't know, I guess non-trivial like queer community. Not that like, because I know last season you were talking about like the Seattle like Buy Nothing and the queer exchange and stuff like that, which was a little bit more light, which isn't bad. Like, I think we need queer community at like several levels, but I really love that you chose a
absolutely
really profound one to talk about.
Luckily, we only have two questions left. So the next one is, what are your hopes for future endeavors with archives? And does it involve archiving queer history? And tell us about your queer dreams.
My hope for archives in general is that I think that there are a lot of opportunities for archives to address systemic harm and historic harm that have happened to not just queer people, but to other marginalized groups as well. And I think that archives could be a very cool, very radical space to open up ideas like reparations and like, you know, the right to be forgotten or not remembered. I think that those kinds of things are all really, really interesting to me. And I'm hopeful that those things will happen. I would like to get back into archives. For me, I think where I'm at right now in terms of like if it's queer archives is I think I think that anything can be queer if a queer person is involved. I think that that's kind of like where my like impulse is right now. I think that that is kind of like where I see my future. And maybe that's my queer dream. My real queer dream is like a commune, I think. I would really like, yes, I would really like to join, like to establish a queer commune with my comrades here and other places, and just like not have to work for state government and just like work for ourselves and like really like ruminate on like the ideas of, like what work and labor mean, and like how that all fits into queerness as well. But yeah, I think that my queer dream, yeah, is my aspirational queer dream is to start a commune. My like realistic one is to just like continue kind of doing what I am right now, like being in a community with other queer people that I trust and that I love. Like, you know, hanging out with my girlfriend and our cat and reading books for fun sometimes when my brain doesn't hurt too bad. I think that's the queer dream for me these days.
That's so good. Okay, well, I think, so our actual final question is just the fun wrap up one. But we were wondering, like, if you were to donate a queer artifact from your personal collection to an archives, what would it be?
Yes, this is the question that I have been thinking about, and I like very truly still don't know if I have an answer, because I'm hesitant to say something like, you know, like I like to put in something that would like be representative of like my relationship with my partner, because I think that, again, said a couple of times, like queerness isn't like, it's not just like about romantic relationships with other queer people. So like, I'm hesitant to put in something like that. I'm also hesitant to put in something super like, you know, like pop culture-y for fear that it would embarrass myself later down the line. I really think that like an oral history, or like, I don't know, just like me, like turning on like a tape recorder and just like talking to my friends. That's, I think, the thing that I would want to, like my queer artifact would be just like a conversation between me and my friends. That's what I kind of think is missing from queer archives. And that's what I think I would want to contribute because of that.
Snap to that. That was such a good answer. Oh, okay.
I'm like super curious about the other answers you're getting though. Like if you could tell me like maybe what your two are, if you've thought about this question.
I think we have. You're being really like smart and strategic about this question, because you're right, it does ask you for just one thing, and that puts a lot of pressure. But I think you're right, you get a lot of mileage out of an oral history, so I think that's a really good thing. And yeah, I don't know, I was kind of thinking more along the lines of a single object, but now you're like blowing my answer out of the water.
I was just gonna say my like collection of pop culture figurines, but then you kind of hit it and said, oh, I don't want to like embarrass myself with pop culture. So I was like, shit, what else am I gonna do?
But like, I don't know, I don't think your pop culture objects are embarrassing in and of itself. I just think that I'm like very insecure about being judged for my like material possessions.
I think I second that for you, Chalyn, because I think you're really good at collecting like actually like really cool and like unique things, whereas I see myself as kind of like a little gay baby, so I'm really interested in like people's gay awakenings. So yeah, so I think, because my original answer was gonna be like something along the lines of like my first like concert ticket to like, I don't know, I think one of my gay awakenings was I went to a Tove Lo concert, and I don't know, she has like this album called Ladywood. But anyways, but I think even more interesting now that I'm thinking about oral history is I think it would be really cool to like, if I had somehow, yeah, getting back to the surveillance thing, like recorded my questions during like when I watched like for my very first time RuPaul's Drag Race with my friend Drake. And I just had so many questions, and he was like such a patient like mentor for me and like explaining like what the fuck was going on and stuff. And I just think there's just so many moments throughout everyone's like little gay awakening.
Yeah, that sounds really cool too. Yeah, I think that like the gay awakening period of like every queer person's life is like so like special and so just like dark also sometimes too, like that I think that the idea of like documenting questions in particular is like super interesting. Like what do you like to be able to like go back to that time in your life and like think about what you didn't know but what you wanted to know, and also having people there to answer you as well. Like I feel like that in and of itself, including that in like an archival collection, like not just questions but answers, like very 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 like a positive, you have questions but you have someone who can answer them for you in like a patient understanding mm-hmm. way, I think is like, to me that's like the queer joy that I'm looking for.
Well, I think that was all the questions we had. Challen, do you want to do the like little wrap up bit?
Yeah. So once again, thank you so much, Abby, for chatting with us. We really appreciate it. And your conversation was absolutely incredible. We would like to give you this space right now to share any projects that you're working on, anything you want to promote, social media, podcasts, some art that you have, a website, you know, whatever. Feel free to do that now.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for this opportunity. I had a great time talking to both of you as well, and I'm really excited to hear the rest of your podcast episode. In terms of what I've got going on, I am really excited about presenting at Northwest Archivists Conference, the Southwest Archivists, and the Society of American Archivists conferences in the coming months. That's exciting. It's an exciting thing that's happening in my life. If you have a local mutual aid network or community bail bond, I would encourage you to, you know, if this podcast took you an hour to listen to and, you know, your hourly wage, I would recommend donating that much money to a community action network, mutual aid, community bail bond. That's it.
Thanks for listening to the second episode of Queer Air Season 2. Opening sound effects are from zapsplat.com and music is Gravy by Poddington Bear from Free Music Archive.
There's one that's like, which lesbian earrings are you? The one I think I got was a like croc, like a single croc, and then like maybe like a Home Depot shopping cart.
I love that because I have like a love-hate relationship with both Crocs and Home Depot. I really hope that someday a croc makes it into every archive.